It's Tuesday, January 21, 2014. I'm Albert Mobler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Years ago, feminists came up with a slogan. It was this: the fetus beat us. That was a very simple reference to the fact that when women see the ultrasound image of their unborn child, they are far less likely actually to move forward in an attempt to get an abortion. That comes to the forefront of the nation's headlines when on Friday of last week, a federal judge in North Carolina, U.S. District Judge Catherine Eagles, ruled that a North Carolina law that required women seeking an abortion to see the ultrasound image of their unborn child is unconstitutional. She wrote in her decision, quote, "The Supreme Court has never held that a state has the power to compel a health care provider to speak in his or her own voice the state's ideological message in favor of carrying a pregnancy to term, and this court declines to do so today," end quote. A couple of very interesting issues here, both of them alarming. Here you have a federal judge who says that the very act of compelling a woman to see an ultrasound of the unborn life within her is, to use the very language from Judge Eagles' document, mandating the state's ideological message in favor of carrying a pregnancy to term. Very interesting. I'm not sure she's wrong about that, as a matter of fact. I think she's wrong that that's the issue, but she's certainly right that that was behind the legislative intent of this particular statute in North Carolina. And it's very interesting that she, in her own judicial decision, actually specifies the content of the message the ultrasound implies, and that is, don't kill me. It's a very interesting statement, and of course, the judge here has transferred that message from the ultrasound to the medical professional, the doctor who would have to be consulting with the woman seeking an abortion, but the reality is so fundamental. It tells us something profound. It tells us that our eyes refuse to lie when we're looking at an unborn child. The reality is this: once a woman seeking an abortion, or a woman who's pregnant under any circumstances, sees the image of that unborn child, there's a bonding that takes place simply by the visualization of the child. The eyes refuse to believe that the child is anything other than a child. And once that child is seen, it then takes on the persona of a child. And what we have is a major moral issue here that is being played out once again in the courts, and it's being played out in a way that this judge in North Carolina says is unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional to require a woman seeking an abortion to see the ultrasound. Why? Because implicit, no, indeed explicit, in this judge's decision is that the ultrasound itself carries a message. That's a profound pro-life affirmation. The fact that the ultrasound, simply by being the image of an unborn child, carries a message is a profound pro-life observation. But furthermore, this story also tells us something about the extremity of the positions that are now facing each other on the issue of the sanctity of human life, on the issue of abortion and related issues in this country. Jennifer Rudinger, executive director of the ACLU of North Carolina, said in reference to the judge's decision, quote, "Today's court ruling protects the rights of women and their doctors from the ideological agenda of extremist lawmakers," end quote. Extremist? What does the word extremist mean? It means someone on the far extreme of a spectrum. It's a word that's used in politics or in propaganda to try to marginalize debate. But what in the world does extremist mean here? Well, this particular person representing the ACLU of North Carolina means that anyone who would affirm that a woman ought to see that image with a message, that is, that ultrasound, is an extremist. Of course, what she's dealing with here is that this was adopted by a majority of both houses of the North Carolina legislature. And it was, polling data demonstrates, supported by the majority of the citizens of North Carolina. So who are the extremists? The majority of people in North Carolina. So who's the real extremist? The one who calls the majority of the people of North Carolina extremists. Meanwhile, on the same issue, shifting to Europe, yesterday's edition of the New York Times included a story with the headline, "Proposed Abortion Restrictions in Spain Face Backlash." Rafael Mender, reporting for the New York Times, tells us that Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy's proposal to enact some of the toughest abortion restrictions in Europe has exposed his already unpopular government to a building political backlash and criticism from the European Parliament, while reinvigorating his socialist opponents and opening divisions in his own conservative popular party. A lot in that opening paragraph. By the way, that's the way a lead paragraph in a major news article should be written. Virtually everything you need to know about the story was in that one first lead paragraph. But let's unpack it. First of all, let's note that what this story tells us is that the Prime Minister of Spain is trying to get his government to adopt new restrictions on abortion. We're talking here about Spain, an overwhelmingly Catholic country. But under the leadership of the socialist government that he replaced, The socialists moved to adopt liberalized abortion laws, to adopt the legalization of same-sex marriage, and even the last socialist prime minister moved to try to make men, by the force of law, take on equal responsibilities for housekeeping in the home, domestic duties, as women. That law didn't get very far. But what you are looking at here is the fact that in Europe there's been a steady move towards the liberalization of abortion laws, even in highly Catholic countries like Spain. And yet, in Spain, there is now a movement, as represented by the election of this conservative government, to restrict abortion. In other words, to do a course correction. And that's what has the liberal consensus in Europe absolutely aflame. You see, every worldview implies a narrative. The conservative worldview, the liberal worldview, a democratic worldview, a republican worldview. You can have many different angles on these worldviews, but when it comes to the sanctity of human life, those who believe that abortion is a great moral evil have their own narrative. So do those who believe that abortion is a woman's right, a fundamental woman's right. The narrative of the pro-abortion camp, that pro-abortion worldview, has been towards the eventual, progressive, ongoing liberalization of abortion laws. That narrative also holds that a woman's right to choose should be increasingly, not decreasingly, recognized by all right-thinking people. Of course, the worldview of the pro-life movement follows a narrative that says very clearly that what happened in the second half of the 20th century was a disastrous assault upon human dignity that must be corrected. The worldview narrative of the pro-abortion movement is that it must not be corrected. And thus, when you have any kind of movement back towards a restriction on abortion, you have people on the pro-abortion side who say, fundamentally, this can't happen. In other words, this violates their complete understanding of history. And if you're looking at it in Spain, as this story helps us to see, realize the same thing's going on in the United States. There are those on the left who simply can't believe. They just scratch their heads with incredulity that 40 years plus after Roe v. Wade, we're still talking about abortion. And they're absolutely beside themselves that just in the last 36 months, something like over 70 restrictions on abortion have been adopted by various states in the United States. In other words, their narrative has run into a hard, cold wall of reality. Evidence of the fact that this has people in the pro-abortion movement internationally absolutely in consternation comes in the New York Times story, quote, "The abortion debate has transcended Spain's borders. Protests were recently held outside Spain's embassy in Paris, and France's Minister for Women's Affairs, Najat Vallaud-Bacaman, said it was, quote, terrible to see Spain about to take a step back on the right to decide over one's own body," end quote. The New York Times also tells us that last week the European Parliament held a heated session over what Spain's planned U-turn would mean for the rest of the continent. In Portugal, news media have started speculating about whether the country's abortion clinics could cope with an influx of women from neighboring Spain. As it stands right now, the only European country that has an absolute legal ban on abortion is the tiny little island of Malta. Shifting back to the United States, President Barack Obama has given a massive, lengthy interview to the magazine The New Yorker. The New Yorker is one of those barometer magazines of the cultural left. It is addressed to sophisticates in Manhattan, although it has a very wide, nationwide readership. It is also a magazine that has given birth to many of the most illustrious literary careers of the 20th century. It's one of those magazines that makes a difference. And in this case, this interview might make a difference. It is, as I said, a massive interview, but right now the headlines are over just one topic in the interview, and that topic is marijuana. The background of this, of course, is the liberalization of abortion laws, the adoption of legal recreational marijuana in a state like Colorado. And in the background of this, President Obama was asked about it, and he said, quote, "As has been well documented, I smoked pot as a kid, and I view it as a bad habit and a vice, not very different from the cigarettes that I smoked as a young person up through a big chunk of my adult life. I don't think it's more dangerous than alcohol." The president said this in the interview with The New Yorker, and now that has made headline news all over the country and indeed all over the world. The main headlines, by and large, are saying that the president's most significant statement was that he doesn't believe that marijuana is more dangerous than alcohol. As a matter of fact, he not only said he doesn't think it's more dangerous than alcohol, he implied that it's probably less dangerous than alcohol. But two points related to the issue of marijuana in this interview deserve our very close worldview attention. The first has to do with what President Obama said about marijuana and his own two daughters. He said this. He said, "I don't want them to smoke marijuana because marijuana is, quote, not something I encourage, and I told my daughters I think it's a bad idea, a waste of time, not very healthy," end quote. Well, let's get to the bottom line of that statement. Certainly everything the president said about marijuana is true. We would certainly emphatically agree that it's not something we should encourage. It's a bad idea, a waste of time, not very healthy. Of course, that really doesn't get to the heart of the issue, does it? It doesn't even get to the issue of intoxication whatsoever. It doesn't deal at all with the reality, as has now been well documented, that in the adolescent brain, marijuana has a very dangerous and long-lasting, if not permanent, effect. It doesn't deal with the whole issue of impairment. It doesn't deal with the potential of addiction, which, again, goes way up when you're dealing with adolescent smoking. But let's take the three things he said. It's a bad idea, a waste of time, not very healthy. Let me just ask you, if you are an adolescent, or you can still remember when you were an adolescent, does that sound like a very strong argument? This is my point. Any parent who reduces the arguments to 3 points of this weakness is a parent that better be ready for his children or her children to smoke marijuana or to do whatever he supposedly doesn't want them to do, but can muster only an argument that it is a waste of time, a bad idea, and not very healthy. That's true of gummy bears. Now, in all likelihood, I actually believe that this president holds up a pretty good model of fatherhood. And so, in all likelihood, I think he's probably actually saying a great deal more to his daughters than he told the New Yorker. But this is what he told the New Yorker. This is what he's telling the country. And I think it sends a very dangerous, but at the same time, revealing message. But the other portion of the president's comments on marijuana that deserves a deep worldview consideration is where the president told the New Yorker that he doesn't like the fact that there is a disproportionate representation of people who are arrested and then imprisoned for the use or the sale of marijuana, particularly the use of it. He says, as the Associated Press reports, the president said it was important for the legalization of marijuana to go forward in those states to avoid a situation in which only a few are punished while a large number of people have broken the law at one time or another. The president said, and I quote, middle-class kids don't get locked up for smoking pot and poor kids do. And African-American kids and Latino kids are more likely to be poor and less likely to have the resources and the support to avoid unduly harsh penalties, end quote. Well, the president is certainly right that there is a disproportionate representation. But, of course, there's a disproportionate representation in the originating arrest that led to the complication of the charges related to drugs. There is, by the way, as Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals can agree, a real issue to be faced here when you're looking at a lot of mandatory sentences and you're looking at some of the three strikes laws and you're looking at some other things that mean that people with relatively low-level crimes can be locked up for many years or for a life sentence. That's a genuine problem that does test the judicial system and certainly raises basic issues of justice. But when you're looking at the president's actual argument, what would he say about tax evasion? After all, it's more widespread in all likelihood than what he's talking about in terms of marijuana use. And what he's talking about here is he says it's unfair to lock some people up for what other people are probably doing. Well, that probably relates to speeding, tax evasion, and any number of other laws. In other words, that's a really bad argument for a lawyer to make, much less for a lawyer who happens to have been elected as President of the United States. A third worldview issue here, and I'm not throwing stones at President Obama personally for this, but he made the statements himself in his own voice. He said, and I quote again, as has been well documented, I smoked pot as a kid, and I view it as a bad habit and a vice, not very different from the cigarettes I smoked as a young person up through a big chunk of my adult life. In other words, when the president talks about a lot of those people who did do drugs, in this case, marijuana, but didn't get arrested, he's talking about himself. And I think that's one of the big issues for the baby boomer generation in particular. President Obama's a little young to be in the baby boom generation, although he may be at the very last stage of it. But the reality is nonetheless this. There are an awful lot of adults now who say, I have a very hard time holding a moral line on an issue because I didn't hold it to myself when I was a young person or a young adult. Well, we can admit this much. Parents do find themselves on weaker moral ground when they tell their children not to do what they have to admit they did themselves. There was a book that came out about 20 years ago entitled How to Keep Your Kids from Doing in the 90s What You Did in the 60s. Now, the book's already dated, but the point isn't. But there's a contrary point to this, and every parent has to know this in his or her heart, as well as every judge who sits on any bench. If only the sinless can talk about the avoidance of sin and the reasons for avoiding sin, then we, as a human race, are doomed. Because as the Bible says emphatically clearly, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But let me end where I began. The big problems with this interview have to do with the message the president's sending to the nation. I really do have some significant confidence that the actual signal the president's sending to his daughters is a bit more substantial than this interview would reveal. This time of the year, a lot of international attention is directed to Davos, Switzerland with the World Economic Forum, and that forum has released recently a report that assesses 31 global risks, and it released the 10 most significant threats facing the world in 2014. Well, there are still at least 11 months and a few days left in this year, so we better know what these 10 gravest threats are. Number one, fiscal crises in key economies. Number two, structurally high unemployment or underemployment. Number three, water crises. Number four, severe income disparity. Number five, failure of climate change, mitigation, and adaptation. Number six, greater incidence of extreme weather events. Number seven, global governance failure. Number eight, food crises. Number nine, failure of a major financial mechanism or institution. And number 10, profound political and social instability. As most informed people looking at this list will now recognize, that's pretty much the list from last year. And in all likelihood, those who follow the same concerns are probably going to have the same list next year. Because the one thing that binds all of these issues together is that there is very little anyone, including the World Economic Forum, can do about these grave moral, cultural, political, seismic, economic issues. But when it comes to the issues closer to us, that's what we need to recognize. The Christian worldview holds that we start locally. We start right where we are. The important issue is, what about our marriage? What about our family? What about our economic activity? What about our job? What about our community? That's a principle in theology known as subsidiarity. In other words, the most important things start small, where we are. The global issues are the accumulation of untold numbers of local issues, and they can only be fixed locally, never globally. And even the World Economic Forum must know this as it comes up with the list of the 10 big things to scare us for this year. Finally, have you ever had that impression that you woke up and the world had changed? Well, what if you actually did have that experience? Hiro Onoda, an Imperial Japanese Army officer who remained at his jungle post for an island in the Philippines for 29 years after the end of World War II, died last week in Japan. He died last Thursday at age 91. As Robert McFadden of the New York Times reports, his death at a hospital in Japan was announced by the Japanese government. Listen to this paragraph. Quote, caught in a time warp, Mr. Onoda, a second lieutenant, was one of the war's last holdouts, a soldier who believed that the emperor was a deity and the war a sacred mission, who survived on bananas and coconuts and sometimes killed villagers he assumed were enemies, who finally went home to the lotus land of paper and wood, which turned out to be a futuristic world of skyscrapers, television, jet planes, pollution, and atomic destruction. You talk about the importance of worldview. Lieutenant Onoda's worldview held that the emperor was a deity and that it was impossible that Japan could be defeated. Therefore, when all kinds of pamphlets were dropped near him, when messages were sent that he was able to intercept saying that Japan had surrendered, he refused to believe. He refused to believe for 29 years. The last orders he had been given by his Japanese commander were to stay at his post until he was relieved. And he wasn't relieved for 29 years. When people who were trying to track down some of these final soldiers of World War II recognized that he must be the soldier who was detected by others living in the Philippines, who did know that he had killed villagers and continued to believe that the war was ongoing. One very interesting section from the Times obituary. His ordeal of deprivation may have seemed a pointless waste to much of the world, but in Japan it was a moving reminder of the redemptive qualities of duty and perseverance. End quote. Big problem there. There was nothing in the least redemptive about his commitment, his duty, or his perseverance. All those qualities may have stood out in terms of the contrast of those who surrendered and gave up. But on the other hand, there was nothing even remotely redemptive about his life after the war was over. There are all kinds of sermon illustrations and parables we could find from this, from those who simply do not accept that the war is over and keep on fighting a pointless war, to those who hold to a worldview against all evidence. In this case, against all evidence being that Japan not only had surrendered, but was a fundamentally different nation. But you know, the biggest parabolic value of this to me is imagining a man who leaves one country only to come back and find a very different civilization. Years ago, John Howard of the Howard Institute said of the United States and World War II that it was then a half century, but a whole civilization ago. When you consider the issues we've been discussing for just the last few minutes, do we not recognize the same? You don't have to have lived for 29 years on a Philippine island believing that the war is still going to sometimes wake up and wonder if the world you now see is real. But it is, and that's why we talk about it. Before I close, I want to invite you once again to join me, along with nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager and New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, for a conversation about faith and freedom in the public square. Our goal is to have an open and honest dialogue about the challenges we face as a nation and civilization. Join us January 28th at 7 o'clock p.m. on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. For tickets and more information, go to www.hashtagpros.com. That's hashtag PROS.com. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.